So yeah, good morning, and let me first thank the organizers for the invitation to this workshop. So it's, I think it's a very nice opportunity to be here. So I would like to tell you a bit about our recent progress in simulating 2D fermionic and frustrated systems with these two-dimensional tensor networks. So I assume not all of you are very familiar with tensor networks. So essentially, it's a field which lies somewhere in between quantum information theory and condensed matter physics. And I think in the end, it's a very nice example of an interdisciplinary field which has really profited a lot from combining ideas, because in the end, this has led to very powerful tools to simulate strongly correlated systems. So for those of you who know the DMRG method, you can also see this as a generalization of DMRG to higher dimensions. So the goal of this talk would to try to convince you that these two-dimensional tensor networks have indeed become very useful and also competitive tools. And I will show you this with two recent applications. So the first is the TJ model, which was done in collaboration with Maurice Rice and Matthias Troyer at ETH. And then the second example is a frustrated spin system, the Shastri-Sutherland model, which I did together with Frederic Miller at EPFL. Okay, but let me just start maybe with the very general motivation for this entire field, which in the end was also my personal motivation why I started working on these methods now about 7 years ago when I joined Geoffrey Vidal as a postdoc in Australia. Because we would really like to have an accurate and reliable tool for the study of strongly correlated systems, so including models related to high TC, which is of course still one of the big unsolved problems, but then also other systems like spin liquids in frustrated magnets or new states of matter that could be realized with ultra-cold atoms. So as you know, studying these models is typically very challenging because there's no exact analytical solution and standard theoretical approaches like mean field or perturbation theory typically fails here. And that's why in many cases, accurate and efficient numerical simulations are really essential. Now, one of the most powerful methods to do this is quantum Monte Carlo, where the main idea is to do a statistical sampling of this exponentially large configuration space. So it's really very powerful for many spin and bosonic systems. So take, for example, the square lattice Heisenberg model, where it's known that the ground state has a nil order. Then if you look at this state-of-the-art study by Sandvik and Everts, they went up to system sizes of 256 squared. Right, which corresponds to a huge Hilbert space. But with quantum Monte Carlo, you can deal with this and then compute quantities of interest, like the order parameter, up to very high precision. Right, so it's really amazing what you can do with quantum Monte Carlo, but there is this huge but. Namely, it fails for important classes. So it works for bosons. So remember, when you exchange two bosons, this leaves your wave function invariant. And that's when quantum Monte Carlo works. However, if you take fermions, then you know you get this minus sign here. And this, in the end, gives rise to this infamous negative sign problem. Okay, so I will not go into the details. But what it finally implies is that the simulation time scales exponentially with system size and inverse temperature, which means that you can't really solve large systems at low temperatures, right? So this sign problem can really be seen as one of the biggest problems in computational physics. And then also one of the main reasons why there are still so many basic models which are still unsolved. And probably the most prominent example is the 2D fermionic Hubbert model, which, as you know, is a very simple model of interacting electrons, so just with a nearest neighbor hopping and an on-site repulsion. And already a long time ago, it was suggested that this could contain kind of the important physics to understand high TC. So there's a big interest in solving this accurately. And it has been studied really by many different methods, but however, which led to different answers. And that's why still today, the ground state phase diagram of the Hubbert model is still controversial. Then another class of important models where quantum Monte Carlo fails are frustrated systems. So take the Heisenberg model we had before, where the spins would like to be anti-parallel. So this works on a square lattice, and in this case, quantum Monte Carlo works. But if you take, for example, a triangle, then the system is frustrated, and here, quantum Monte Carlo fails. quantum Monte Carlo also has a sign problem. Of course, frustrated systems are also fundamentally important in condensed matter physics, but because of the sign problem, it's very hard to study these models. So in order to make progress in condensed matter physics, it's really important to develop new and accurate methods to study these systems. And now there's a long list of different approaches, and all have their advantages and disadvantages. And now among the most promising ones are these tensor network algorithms. And the reason is that these tensor networks have already been extremely successful for the simulation of one-dimensional systems. And this is thanks to the well-known DMRG method, so the density matrix normalization group, which has an underlying tensor network Ansatz, a matrix product state. Okay, so I'll explain in a minute how to read this picture. Then there are also other tensor networks, like, for example, the MIRA, the multi-scale entanglement normalization Ansatz, and some others like tree tensor networks. Now, already a couple of years ago, these tensor networks have been generalized to two dimensions. And of course, the goal is to repeat this enormous success of DMRG with a tensor network that is specially designed for 2D systems. Now, it turns out that the involved algorithms here are far more complicated than in one dimension with MPS. So it took quite some time to develop all these methods. But nevertheless, in recent years, there's really been a lot of progress with these methods. And with the examples I show you today, you can also get a feeling of what we can currently do with these methods. Okay, but one important message is also that this is kind of still at the beginning, because there's still many ways how to further improve these methods so that we can even get higher accuracy in future. Okay, so here's the outline of my talk. So I will first start with a short introduction to these tensor network algorithms, and then in particular to the IPEPS method, which is the approach I'm using. Then I will show you our results for the TJ model, where we found an extreme close competition between different low energy states. So with a superconducting D-wave state and also with different types of stripe states. And an important message here is also that IPEPS as a variational method is really very competitive. So we can really get lower variational energies than in the previous state-of-the-art calculations. Then I will also show you some first results for the Hubber model, where we find a similar competition between these states. Then in the next part, I would like to tell you how IPEPS help to get new insights into an old problem in frustrated magnetism, namely the Shastri-Sutherland model, which is an effective model for strontium copper borate. So here we really found surprising results, which are in contradiction with all the previous theoretical predictions from the last 15 years. And thanks to these new results, we got a new understanding of the magnetization process in this material. So it's somehow a nice example which shows how we can kind of get new insights thanks to simulations which are largely unbiased. Okay, so let me start just with a very basic introduction for those who don't know about tensor networks. So the main goal is to have an efficient variational Ansatz for quantum many-body states. And now we will typically consider ground states of local Hamiltonians. Right, so let's take a lattice with n sites, where each site is described by some local Hilbert space. So for example, with dimension 2, so the full Hilbert space grows exponentially with n. And then we typically consider local Hamiltonians, so for example, with nearest neighbor interactions. So if you want to represent the ground state in general, you need 2 to the power of n expansion coefficients here. Right? So these are the expansion coefficients in this tensor product basis here, where you have some overall lattice sites where each ik goes over the two basis states. Right? So there are exponentially many numbers here, which is, of course, not efficient. Now let's make a simple example with 6 sites. So we have these coefficients here. Now you can see, you can also see them as a multi-dimensional array with 6 indices, or we can also call it a rank 6 tensor. And we can now graphically represent this with this big shape here, which has six legs attached to it, which correspond to these six indices. And now the idea is very simple, namely we want to decompose this big tensor into small pieces, as for example shown here, right? So this collection of small tensors which are connected by lines, so this is what we mean by a tensor network. Now to each of these connections here, we can associate a Hilbert space which has a certain dimension, d, which is called the bond dimension, right? So this index e here runs over d different elements. Now we can evaluate this network simply by multiplying all these tensors together. So that's the product here, and then sum over these connections here, A, B, C, D, and E. So that's done here. And if we do this contraction, we obtain a new psi tilde, and the aim is now that this is an accurate approximation of the exact psi, right? But now the important difference is that here we have exponentially many numbers, whereas in a tensor network ansatz, the number of parameters scales only polynomially with this bond dimension d and the number of lattices. And that's what we mean by an efficient representation. Of course, you might wonder why such a decomposition is possible. And the reason here is that the states we're interested in, so the ground states of local Hamiltonians are special. And what makes them special is that they're much less entangled than if you just take, if you pick a random state out from your Hilbert space. And that's expressed in this well-known area law of the entanglement entropy. So which says that if you look at the block A in your system, that the entanglement entropy grows not as the volume of A, but only with its boundary. And now a tensor network exploits this. So a tensor network is not necessarily a good ansatz for any state in a Hilbert space, so that would not be possible, but it's designed in such a way that it can reproduce, for example, such an area law. Of course, there are exceptions, so there are critical states which violate this area law, which have a logarithmic correction, but this is still a mild violation compared to a volume law, and typically we can still use tensor networks as an approximate tool for these cases. Okay, so let's go back to the MPS. So again, we have exactly one tensor per lattice site, and the tensors are connected by this bond here with bond dimension D, right? So in the end, this bond dimension D controls the size of the tensors, or in other words, the number of variational parameters you have in your ansatz. So by increasing D, you have a way how to systematically improve your ansatz. Now, early on, people wanted to use this to simulate also two-dimensional systems. And the most straightforward way to do that is simply to put this ansatz on a two-dimensional lattice with such a snake here. And in the end, this boils down to mapping your 2D system onto a 1D system with long-ranged interactions. But then the problem with this is that one can show that the computational cost in this case scales exponentially with the length here of the system. And the reason is that if you make a cut through your system, for example here, then the entanglement between the left and the right side will grow linearly with this length here, and all the entanglement has to go through this single bond here. And as a consequence, you have to increase this bond exponentially. Okay, so nevertheless, you can use this approach if your system size is not too large in 2D. And there have been very remarkable calculations using this thing. And typically, people would use long cylinders where this dimension here is short and the other one can be long. But now, if you want to do large systems in 2D, this approach will fail because of this exponential scaling. So in order to overcome this exponential scaling, two-dimensional tensor networks have been developed, so which can reproduce an area law in two dimensions. And now the most natural extension of an MPS to two dimensions is this PEPS here, or a projected entangled pair state, also called a tensor product state. So as in the MPS, we have exactly one tensor per lattice site, but now you see each of the tensors is connected by four bonds to all the nearest neighbors. And one can easily show that this ansatz can reproduce an area law in 2D. Now, this is an ansatz for a finite systems in 2D, but now there's also a special version for infinite systems, which is called an IPES. So with this, you can represent a 2D wave function directly in the thermodynamic limit. And of course, the advantage here is that there are no finite size and boundary effects here. Now, if your system is translationally invariant, you can parametrize your wave function by just one single tensor here, which you simply repeat everywhere in your lattice. So that's a very compact representation of an infinite 2D wave function. But now the problem is that here we're working in the thermodynamic limit, so translational symmetries can in principle also be spontaneously broken. So in practice, what we do is to use a unit cell of tensors. So like, for example, here, a 4 × 2 unit cell, which is periodically repeated. And this unit cell should match the ground state, the structure of the ground state, so the symmetry breaking pattern. But of course, we typically don't know the symmetry breaking pattern of the ground state in advance. So what we do in practice is to run simulations with different unit cell sizes and then just check which unit cell gives the lowest energy, and that would then be our ground state. Okay, so this is the approach I'm using, and I will show you results later. So far, I have only talked about the ansatz. So, and again, besides the MPS and PEPS, there are also other structures like the MIRA, which has some nice properties. But of course, in the end, there are other ingredients in the entire algorithm, right? So again, we have a variational ansatz, and kind of the next step is then to find the best variational parameters to have the best representation of the ground state. So I will not really have time to go into the details. So one approach to do this is to do an iterative optimization where you just go through your tensor network and kind of optimize one tensor after the other in an iterative way to minimize the energy. Or another way is to perform an imaginary time evolution. Okay. So then once you have found the best state, you can then compute quantities like the energy or correlation functions or entanglement spectra, and so on. And to do this, you have to contract the tensor network. And now, in the case of the MPS and the MIRA, this contraction can be done in an exact way. But in PEPS and IPEPS, you can't do it in an exact way. So you need an additional approximate method to do this contraction. But there exist different methods, and this can be done in the end in a controlled way. And also, you will hear about the latest developments about these 2D contractions, I guess, in the next talk by Giffre Vidal. let's see. Okay, in any case, these are kind of the main steps in a tensor network algorithm. And then just one last final remark. You might wonder if we can actually simulate fermions with these 2D tensor networks, because the challenge is how to include fermionic statistics in your ansatz. But this is indeed possible, and that has been worked out about 6 years ago by many different groups. So, I mean, there are kind of different formulations of the same thing. So all these formulations in the end represent or are about the same fermionic tensor network ansatz. Okay, so also here, I will not go into the details, but the message in the end is that indeed we can also do fermions. Yes?
So this contraction?
Yes. So in the end, it is. So one way to contract the two-dimensional tensor networks is indeed to see it as a matrix product state on the boundary, and then sequentially you apply matrix product operators to this boundary. These are steps which are done in DMRG. So in the end, you can really use DMRG techniques for the contraction of these two-dimensional tensor networks. So that's one of the approaches which is being used.
But in 3D,
it's 3D. Well, there are ways to do it, but so that has been one of our discussions in the last couple of
days.
Yes, yeah, exactly. I can see like exactly. In 1D, it gets more complicated when you go to higher dimensions to compute the leading eigenvector of the transfer matrix. there are different things. I mean, we can, I'm happy to discuss also details later. Okay, so before coming to the applications, maybe just one first benchmark result for the Heisenberg model, where we have an accurate quantum Monte Carlo estimate. So here you see the energy which is extrapolated to the thermodynamic limit. That's 2D. Yes, that's 2D. And here's our IPEPS result for a bond dimension of 10. So here we did not use any extrapolation. So that's a variational energy. And then you see we get quite a nice accuracy on the energy. Of course, what is harder to get is a good estimate of the order parameter, which is the stagger magnetization in this case. So these are, let me show you first the quantum Monte Carlo results. So that's the order parameter as a function of 1 over the system size. You can compute it in two different ways and then extrapolate it to the thermodynamic limit here and then obtain a very precise value. But on the other hand, you can also see that they're quite strong finite size effects here. Now in IPEPS, we don't have finite size effects because we are already in the thermodynamic limit, but instead we have strong finite D effects, right? So here we increase the bond dimension and you see we approach the exact result down here. Now the difference here is that here we don't have a nice smooth curve as on this side. So it's not really clear how we should do a nice accurate extrapolation, right? So you can try out different fits and then get an estimate of the order parameter with a few percent accuracy, right? So people are still trying to improve these type of extrapolations. So I'm sure can be done better. But the message here in the end is that we can get a reasonable estimate of the order parameter. And of course, the important thing is now that we can apply this also to cases where quantum Monte Carlo has a sign problem.
So the question, yes. In what sense is finite D the same as finite size?
So let's say in one dimension,
in
this is...
And you have a system with a correlation.
Exactly. This is very well understood, let's say, especially in one dimension, where you see every D leads to a finite correlation length in the end. So in the end, you can do a finite size scaling in this correlation length in a very similar way as you would do finite size scaling in the system size in other approaches. Now in two dimensions, probably something similar exists that you can do a very accurate finite descaling, but it's still not entirely worked out, let's say. But in principle, as you increase the bond dimension, then the correlation length you represent in your system becomes larger. Okay. So then let me move to the first application, which is the TJ model. So that's an effective model of the Haber model in the limit of strong interaction. So as in the Haber model, we have just the nearest neighbor hopping term, but now with a constraint that there can be at most one electron per side. So doubly occupied sides are forbidden, and the neighboring electrons interact via Heisenberg interaction. So now one of the big questions in the last 20 years has been whether the ground state of the TJ model exhibits stripes. So stripes which have also been observed in some of the cuprate superconductors. And so it's essentially a special type of spin and charge density wave with a cartoon picture as shown here. So imagine if you have one electron per side, right? Then you have an antiferromagnet. But the question is really what happens if you start doping the system with holes, right? So do these holes cluster together leading to phase separation, or do the holes spread out uniformly? Or another possibility is that the holes form these domain walls here which separate these antiferromagnetic regions. Now there's a long history about the theory on stripes. So at the beginning, stripes were considered just with charge and spin order. And then later on, it turned out that there can also be coexisting superconductivity. So stripes where spin, charge, and superconducting order are intertwined. So I will show you some pictures later on. Now, for the TJ model, stripes have been previously found in DMRG calculations on cylinders. Whereas in variational Monte Carlo and fictional Monte Carlo, they always found that a uniform D-wave superconducting state is lower in variational energy than stripe states. Okay, and now DMRG is very accurate on cylinders, but people argued that maybe the stripes are simply an artifact of these cylindric boundary conditions. And this in the end motivated us to look at this problem with IPEPS, because here we don't have finite size and boundary effects. And now the good thing is also that with IPEPS, we can reproduce both these competing states by using different unit cell sizes. So we can study the properties of these individual states and then later on compare their variational energies to see which one is really lower. So let's do that. So if we take a 2 × 2 unit cell with just two different tensors here, then we reproduce the uniform D-wave state with coexisting anti-ferromagnetic order, right? So what you see in this picture here are the local order parameters measured from our IPEPS wave function. So the red dots here scale with the whole density. So you see it here, we have the same density on each side. And then the black arrows show you the spin order. And then finally, these colored bonds here show you the nearest neighbor singlet pairing amplitude with different signs in X and Y direction. So typical for D-wave pairing. Here are some results for the pairing amplitude as a function of doping. So here at zero, we are at half filling. And now you see that the pairing gets suppressed with increasing bond dimension. But then we can extrapolate and obtain something which is finite, so for any finite doping. Then here you see the order parameter for the spin order. And also here it gets strongly suppressed with increasing D. And the extrapolated value seems to vanish around 10%. Okay, so in this region here, we obtain coexisting superconducting order with anti-ferromagnetism. Now, these results are in agreement with previous variational studies. But what we can say here is that the best variational energy we obtain here is considerably lower than this previous state-of-the-art result, which was obtained by fixed-dope Monte Carlo combined with two Lanczos steps. Okay, so it seems that we can really go beyond these previous calculations. Yes?
There's no phase separation at very small
doping? Well, it's something which potentially could be, which we, let's say we would need to push the simulations more to see that. So how to say that? So these results are there assuming that there's no phase separation. But really to answer these questions at very small doping, we would need to push the simulations even a bit more. So, but in the end, you will see that the main thing we focused on is this, is the region beyond 10% doping.
But also, one more question. Looks like you guys superconductivity also at very small doping.
Yes.
Quite strong.
Well, it rises quite. Yes, you're right in that sense. So it's not a dome which would start arising only after a certain doping. But it could be once we start adding a T prime, for example, that this would change. At least this has been observed in previous variational calculations.
It's possible that this is a bias of having a 2x2 study. If there's a tendency to phase separation, maybe the system becomes inhomogeneous.
Yes.
And the 2x2 study would mean that
too. Yes, it could, yes, in the end, but I mean, phase separation in the end could be done by you know, doing a Maxwell construction and then seeing if it phase separates. But for that, you need a very good estimate of the actual energies. So in the end, I mean, this would be, it's like a question we did not focus too much on because our main focus was in this region. But it's a very good question. Okay, now we can reproduce stripes by taking larger unit cells. That's now an example of a 5 × 2 unit cell. And now you see the whole density is modulated along the X direction and also the spin order is modulated. And you can also see that there's coexisting superconducting order here, right? Then we also checked what happens to these orders when we go to larger and larger bond dimension. So that's shown here. So it's plotted as 1 over D. So here's the amplitude of the spin order. And you can see it goes down with increasing D, but it seems to remain finite if you go to the infinite D limit. Also, the charge order or the amplitude is suppressed, but there's no sign that it would vanish. And then also superconductivity seems to remain finite.
So what doping is it?
This is at 12% doping.
Perfect.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Do you pick the orientation of the stripe by your unit cell?
Yes. And this, in the end, because it's isotropic, it doesn't matter. But I will show you later results for the anisotropic TJ model, and then of course it matters how you orient it.
So this is a form of phase separation, but it's not the cut of the system.
Right.
It's homogeneous.
In some sort, yes, but it's periodically repeated. So we can of course also get other stripe periods by using other unit cells. And that's shown here, so that's the energy per hole as a function of doping. So this would be a width 4 stripe, here's a width 5 stripe, and here are some examples for larger widths, so width 7 and width 9. And then you can see that the preferred stripe width actually depends on the doping, right? So as you go to smaller doping, the stripe wants to be larger and larger. And also here, I mean, we did not study this region in detail because you would need to go to very large stripe widths, which becomes kind of more challenging. So in the following, we will focus on this density region here, where this stripe, this width 5 stripe are lowest. Then just one side remark about the superconducting order. So if you look at this stripe here, then you have the same sign structure on neighboring stripes. And now also in agreement with previous variational calculations, we find a low energy state which has an antiphase superconducting order. So where where the sign structure on neighboring stripes is reverted. So that's also called a pair density wave order. And these types of stripes have attracted quite some interest thanks to this proposal by Berg et al., where they show that such antiphase stripes can lead to an effective decoupling between the copper-oxygen plane, so a suppression of the interlayer Josephson coupling. And this may explain the lack of 3D superconductivity that has been observed in experiments on LBCO. So I will not really go into the details, but the fact that this state here has almost the same energy as this one in our calculation gives also further support to this proposal. We also found diagonal stripe states. So these are not superconducting. However, when we go to large bond dimensions, it turns out that they're not energetically favored anymore. So I will not really discuss them more here. But now let's come to the showdown and let's compare the variational energies between these two competing states. So here is the energy per hole as a function of 1 over d again. And now for d equals 8, which is here, you see that the uniform state is clearly higher than the stripe state. But now if we go to larger d, something interesting happens, namely both energies come down, and they get closer and closer. And here for d equals 14, they're already very close. Now based on this data, we cannot really tell what's going to happen at even larger bond dimensions. So if they will become equal, or if one of them will be lower when you go to larger d. But nevertheless, what this shows is that even at these very low energies, the states are still strongly competing, which in the end could suggest that probably both these states are in the end important for the low energy physics of the TJ model.
Right? The same is true with the pair density.
Yes, but we did not push it to such large bond dimensions in the end, because the calculation was a bit harder there. So here it's just the in-phase stripe. So in the end, there's maybe a higher principle that explains why these states are so close in energy. Yes?
If you use a small unit cell, say one-sided unit cell, can the system still spontaneously break?
Well, in principle, yes. But the problem is then that to represent the same state, you would need a much higher bond dimension. Because this bond dimension would need to kind of make the superposition of all the different configurations to make the state translational invariant in the end. But then by putting the right boundary, you could nevertheless then break the state and get symmetry breaking. But in a practical calculation, this would never happen somehow because, again, the bond dimension would need to be very large to represent that type of state.
Yeah, sure, that's not what's happening.
Yes. So these are really different states. Yes.
So does your answers include a state with a few distinct eight?
We did that as well, yes.
But experimentally, there is the one that is realized here on eight.
That's right. That's right. Exactly. So if you look at, so in the previous, I showed this plot here with four means with eight in the end. So that's
with four is
a full period of eight. Charge period is four, but spin period is eight.
Yeah,
that's the experiment. Exactly. Exactly. So it's an eight. It's a 2 × 8 unit cell. Yes. Yeah, so that was well. Let me go back to this just to make it clear. This one is a 8 × 2 unit cell, which so you know the charge order has period 4, but the spin.
Four means unit cell 5 8.
Yes, here. So you can see that actually odd width stripes fit also in a odd width unit cell, also for the spin order. Well, you have to draw it and then you will see it. But if you take even width stripes, then for the spin order it will be doubled. Compared to the charge order.
Is this evidence that things are not commensurate?
I'm not sure. I mean, in the end, what we can do here is just kind of commensurate ones and don't get something intermediate. So that's
experimentally, things are not really commensurate.
Yes, right. So it yes, in the end, it can be something in between, I guess.
So but your answer is that you have a tensor of four sites, but you include anti-phasing effect by hand.
No, so in this case, we would really use a unit cell with 8 sites. Yes, in that case, right? And then also for this one, we would use a unit cell of length 10 here, right, to include this.
For the
paired density wave. Whereas here, a unit cell of 5 is enough because you see it's really repeated.
So that's what it's hard
to study. Exactly, it's hard to, I mean, it's. But I would expect something very similar here. Okay. Anyway, so we were here, right? And I mean, in the end, one possibility is also here that we are very close or at a phase transition, which separate these two states, in the sense that if we add small additional terms to the Hamiltonian, we could maybe drive the system from one phase to the other. And now these additional terms will of course be material dependent, and from that perspective, it seems very natural that stripes only appear in certain cuprates, and in other cuprates there are not signs of stripes, right? So in that sense, this competition can also be seen in experiments. So I think to really understand why stripes appear in certain materials, we really have to go beyond these simple models and get an understanding of the of additional terms in the Hamiltonian. Now, one simple thing which we did was to look at the effect of a nematic anisotropy, right? So that's something, a situation which can be found in the LTT phase of LBCO. And we can easily implement this by taking the couplings in X and Y direction differently. And if we do that, we indeed found that the stripe state gets lowered with respect to the uniform state, right? So that such an anisotropy favors the formation of stripes. Okay, so that's a result which has also been previously observed, but we also found some new results here that actually the pairing suppressed if you increase the anisotropy, or that actually the stripe orientation depends on the doping. So depending on the doping, the stripe would prefer to either be horizontal or vertical depending on the doping, and there's a transition in there. Okay, so but in the end, this is of course what we really want to do is to go beyond this and include long-range interactions and hoppings, go to single-band and multi-band Hubbard models, or in principle, we can also study additional ingredients like the coupling between copper-oxygen planes or the role of disorder and so on, and we can then check what the effect on these competing phases is, or we might even find some new low-energy states in more realistic models. So this can all be done with IPEPs, and I think a systematic study here really helped to get a better understanding of all these competing phases. Yes?
Could a uniform state actually be a linear combination of the
stripes? Yes, so that's a good question, but I did not. So we checked also the correlations in the uniform state and did not find stripe correlations in the uniform state. So you mean two-point correlations in the...
Just within the
unit? Yes. No, no, no. You can measure correlations far away as well. Yes, that's no problem. Okay, so just to show you the work in progress, so we did some calculations for Hubbard at U over T10. So we can compare at half filling with quantum Monte Carlo results, and we get a nice accuracy here. No, this at half filling, there's no sign problem. This is half filling, and then this is away from half filling. So again, these are fixed no calculations, and also here you see we get something very similar. So we get lower energies than these state-of-the-art results, and again we obtain a very close competition between stripe and uniform state. Okay, but I think it looks promising that we can really go beyond previous calculations and then hopefully get some new insights into the physics of Hubbard and multiband Hubbard models here. Okay, so then I would go to the second example, which is this frustrated spin system, the Shastri-Sutherland model. It's essentially a Heisenberg model with additional diagonal couplings shown by these dotted lines here. And this model has really a very nice realization here in strontium copper borate, which consists of two-dimensional planes. And I can mark the copper sides in red here, so which carry spin 1/2. And then the lattice you get here is actually the same one as on this side. So another way to draw it would be to take this and rotate it by 45 degrees. But then you can see what the lattice actually is. It's a lattice of orthogonal dimers which are coupled with each other. So let's have a look at the phase diagram. Here's a function of j prime over j. If this is zero, then we are left with only these diagonal couplings here. So the ground state is simply a product of singlets, so a dimer phase. If we go to the other limit, then these bonds here become much stronger than the diagonal ones. So we are in the Heisenberg limit again. So we just have nil order. Now, in between, there have been several suggestions for intermediate phases. And now with IPEPS, we were able to identify this intermediate phase as a placket phase, so one of the previous predictions. So that's a non-magnetic phase, but which breaks translational symmetry and has such a placket long-range order. Now, the compound here lies in the dimer phase, but quite close to this phase transition. And what is now interesting for experiments is to look at this model in a finite magnetic field, so where we add a Zeeman term here, because what has been found in experiments is that several magnetization plateaus appear. So that's magnetization versus external magnetic field. And here's a plateau at 1/8, 1/4, and 1/3. And the theoretical challenge is to explain why these plateaus appear and to explain what kind of states are realized in these plateaus. Now, early on, it has been found that this system has almost localized triplet excitations. So if you take the ground state, so the product of singlets, you can simply form an excitation somewhere locally by putting it into a triplet aligned with the external magnetic field. And now I can easily show that if you put two triplets next to each other, that they feel a repulsion, at least on the mean field level. And this leads to the natural intuition that the magnetization plateaus correspond to crystals of these localized triplets. Okay, so here are some early suggestions how these crystals of triplets could look like. So that would be a suggestion for the 1/8 plateau. So in black, you see the singlets, and I put the triplets in red here. And you see they form a nice crystal structure. Here's another suggestion for the structure at 1/8, and here are some examples at 1/4 and 1/3. So that was back in 2000, and since then there has been a lot of theoretical and experimental work. So new plateaus have been found at 2/15, 1/6, and also 1/3 and 1/2. And in theory, people try to match this sequence, right? But still, after many years, there were still mismatches. So there was a plateau in 1/8 in experiments, but one at 1/9 in theory. And then this 2/15 plateau has always been a bit of a mystery. Why should a plateau appear there and The suggested structures all looked very complicated. So even after 15 years, it seemed to be quite a puzzling problem. And now this seemed to be a very ideal problem. Yes?
So do experiments map out the magnetic structure in the field?
So there are NMR experiments on that. And from that, in theory, they try to match their spin structures they found with this data. Not so the structure itself was in experiments not ambiguously identified in the end. Also, I don't think so. But in the end, the problem was that the matching of the spin structure with experiments somehow had many free parameters. That's why it was never really conclusive. But that was one of the efforts people made. So in any case, so this seemed to be an ideal problem for IPEPs because we can really also simulate very large unit cells. So where all these magnetic structures fit in, right? So the plan was to reproduce all these triplet crystals and then check their variational energy and then see which sequence and what structures are really realized. So that was the plan, but then we got very surprised because in the end it turned out that this original assumption that these plateaus correspond to crystals of triplets is wrong. So at least for the plateaus below 1/4. So let me show you what we found here. So what you see here is the spin structure of one triplet excitation in a 4x4 unit cell. So the triplet has been created here on these two sides. And then you can also see some response from the neighboring sides. Here you see the same for two triplets. And this was obtained with IPEPs using a small bond dimension. If you use a small bond dimension, you reproduce the mean field results. And I mentioned before that on the mean field level, they repel each other, right? That's what you see here. So they try to get far apart from each other. But now if you go to large bond dimensions, then we get something completely different. So this thing here. So first really thought that something is wrong with the simulation, but then really kept on getting these structures, which look a bit like a pinwheel. So this is an SC equals 2 object. So it must be some sort of bound state between the two triplets. So could it be that these crystals are not made of such triplets, but actually of such bound state objects? And that's now something we could easily test just by comparing the variational energies. So here you see the energy beside, again, as a function of 1 over d. And then you see two upper curves. And these correspond to two different triplet crystals. So with one example shown here. And then there are two lower curves, which are essentially on top of each other, which correspond to bound state crystals. And one example is shown here. If you go to small bond dimension, you see, so it's hard to see, but the green one here is lowest. So the triplet crystal here. But if you go to larger bond dimension, they clearly separate in energy. Right, so the bound state crystals are really lower in energy than these triple crystals. So this was what at 1/8, but we found very similar results also for the other plateaus. And in particular, this 2/15 plateau now perfectly makes sense because in terms of these bound state objects, it's just a very regular crystal, right? So it's a regular crystal which has this unit cell of 60 sides. Okay, so then we also computed the binding energy between two triplets. What you see here is that, again, for small bond dimension, they would be repulsive, so something positive. But as we increase the bond dimension, we get really a finite binding energy between the two triplets. And one can also understand where this binding actually comes from. So if you just look at this configuration here, this would not be energetically favorable. But by combining superpositions of these two states, so by letting the triplets resonate around the plaquette, they can gain kinetic energy. And that's what creates a finite binding energy, right? So you should think of this thing here as kind of a superposition of these two states plus additional quantum fluctuations. OK, so then we next computed the lowest energy state for each value of the external magnetic field. And then plotted the resulting magnetization curve. and that's shown here. So I will not go into all details, but finally, what we found is sizable plateaus at 1/8, 2/15, 1/6, 1/5, and 1/4. And not shown is the 1/3 and 1/2 further up. And this matches the experimental sequence except this 1/5 plateau. However, we found that if we add a small but realistic Giolozinski-Maria interaction, which is known to be present in the real compound, then this plateau at 1/5 vanishes and the other remains, right? So that in the end, we can really get the same sequence as an experiment.
So this is in the icing regime? The Giolozinski-Maria favors in the axial
order? That's right. So it was an on-site intra-dimer Giolozinski-Maria. There are many possible anisotropic terms, and it's not fully settled what the values are, but it's believed that it's of the order of a few percent. At this already is enough to destabilize that plateau.
So this is like an excess.
Well, it's a very small contribution to the other couplings in the end. Yes. Okay, so in the end, so we really got surprised here by the IPEPS results, and in the end, I think it's really a nice example of how kind of unbiased simulations can help to get new insights into these old and hard problems. Okay, so then my time is almost up. I just want to say that IPEPS was also useful in finding ground states of SUN Heisenberg models on different lattices. So there's really a very rich variety of different ground states, like, for example, a spin orbital liquid here for the SU4 case on the Honeycomb lattice. So if anyone is interested, I would be very happy to discuss this later. And let me now jump to the conclusion to explain to you what a tensor network ansatz is. So you can simply think of it as a variational ansatz where the accuracy can be systematically improved. Now, I think everyone agrees that in 1D, MPS and DMRG has been the state of the art since more than 20 years. In two dimensions, everything has been more complicated, but there has really been also a lot of progress in recent years. So I have shown you that IPEPS can really be, it's competitive, it can really outperform other state-of-the-art variational methods, and we can really use it also to get new insights into hard problems like the TJ or the Shastri-Sutherland model. Now, I think what's important to emphasize is really that we're still at the beginning here. So there are really many ways how to further improve these methods. And I think this, in the end, is really a very promising perspective, given the accuracy we have already reached now. So that's, I think, that is what makes it very promising. And there's also many possibilities to go beyond ground state simulations, so that you could compute excitations or finite temperature properties and so on. So that's why I really think that it's indeed one of the most promising routes to solve challenging open problems in 2D. And with this, I would like to thank you for your attention.
Questions?
Actually, you gave two talks, so I have two questions.
Yeah, that's good.
On the first part of the talk, the beautiful data you showed. So there's something that always puzzled me, that DMRG on ladders has never seen these sort of regions. And I would have expected to see some similarity.
Yeah, so, but the thing is...
So they usually see, you know, the way in superconductivity, the way in the broad sense of the term, because one way is the way.
Right, right.
But they see stripes, but they never saw the sort of intertwined type
Yeah, that's right. So I could imagine that they could reproduce it, at least as a metastable state.
Yeah.
I think it should be possible. And then even the uniform state, I'm not sure if it was really reproduced. I mean, there are ways also how to enforce certain unit cells in DMRG calculations. So that a uniform state could kind of be enforced to check the properties and variational energies. But I think it has not...
So a state like that is seen, for instance, in the Kondo-Heisenberg chain.
Okay, yeah.
So instead of a Kondo lattice, you use a Kondo-Heisenberg.
Yes, okay.
there, but you need to work with boundary conditions.
I see. Okay.
To actually test the different states, and you do see essentially this anti-phase state.
Yes, that's right. But you see, in the end, I really think the problem is also, I mean, here we really, you see that the stripe state for all the calculations with it was lower in energy, right? So you can see this as a metastable state, which we found by enforcing the unit cell. Whereas in DMRG calculations with the open boundaries and just leaving all the tensors, the whole freedom, you will always get the stripe states, right? Because in the end, I mean, the boundaries, the open boundaries on one end will also favor the formation of stripes in the end.
So the question about the other part.
Yeah.
Some of us have been interested in the magnetization process in Tri-Domain.
Mm-hmm.
And there is evidence both analytical and from numerical results that some of these plateaus, at least in the XY side of the XXC model, may actually be carrier spinning.
Mm-hmm.
And they will. So there is a recent paper by DVA Portland, but they don't see any.
That's right. Types,
they don't see it. Well, I'm not sure.
That's right. On the other hand, yes.
The question is, does this method have problems with higher spin liquids?
Well,
to do something to ask that question.
There are some arguments that you cannot really represent Kyle spin liquid in an exact way. I mean, there's no example. But on the other hand, the question is still if you can identify the phase with an approximate wave function.
I suppose you put a term which is like a chiral operator in every triangle, so to speak.
That's right. I mean,
that
then you then
symmetry.
Of course, then you break it by hand, right?
By hand, but
exactly.
You see chiral spin liquid? No, you still have, you know, you should still have a two-fold degeneracy in the.
Yes, right. So
let's
say I have not. It's a very interesting question, which I would like to investigate. To see where the limitations are in the end. You see, I mean, my feeling is that I can never exactly represent it, but nevertheless, I can maybe see the structure arising, which hints to such a phase. I mean, the same thing is true with Fermi liquids. If you take free fermions, then I know I can never exactly represent it, but nevertheless, by looking at how things behave as a function of D, it would probably tell me that I'm in this phase. So, but let me just say that the calculation by Didier was using some simplified optimization schemes, which anyway would have a hard problem in finding liquid states. So these kind of, because there are many ways how you can optimize the network, and if you use the most simple optimization, which is a bit like a mean field type of optimization, then you can easily get symmetry broken states, but it would be hard to end up in a spin liquid phase. So that can be problematic. Yes?
You have the comparison of the energy for the uniform state and the static state like away from this particular
token. Yes, yes. No, not for such a small doping. So in that case, if you go to 5% doping, you would really need a very long stripe, and then push it to high bond damage. I mean, it's feasible, but it was not the focus. That's right. If you go to very large doping again, then assume that at some point you could clearly see that the uniform state would be better than stripe state. But again, we did not. We just focus on that region here, so it's not. Would be interesting to really see, at least if you go to large doping, that there's a clear separation between the two. Would be good to see that. Yes.
Further questions? Frederick?
How can you tell how big a unit cell you're going to need? I mean, it's also going to be not just the number of sites, but the shape.
That's right, yes. That's a big search space, right? Especially also in the Shastri-Sutherland model, it was really, I mean, we really played around with a lot of different unit cells. So in the end, it's really, you do a search, right? I mean, in the end, at some point, you use a unit cell and you see some structure arising, but then you see that maybe the structure, that there's some mismatch, which gives you a hint that the unit cell should be should be larger. So concretely, in this bound state crystals, we knew how the basic objects look like, and then you can also start to understand how you can actually form crystals using these objects. But in the end, it's true. It's for example, if your state would be an incommensurate state, which does not fit nicely in a small unit cell, then this would be challenging to really study. So then you would really need to go to large and larger unit cells and see that the state actually adapts to a larger unit cell again.
Right, so it's kind of brute force,
but still, like, in the end, yes. But, yeah. Yes?
Is there a control, like, error estimate on the approximate contraction?
Well, I mean, the most easy thing you can do is to look at quantities, how they converge as a function of this additional parameter, right? So when you do an approximate contraction, you have an additional parameter which controls the error of approximation. So is that your question, or?
Yeah, I mean, like, when you make this approximation, you're truncating some of the stuff out, and you're doing the expectation value of whatever you're calculating.
Yes, right, of the wave function, exactly. So let me can show you this here. So that would be examples from the TJ model. So for the two different, so this is for the uniform state, this is for the stripe state. So these are different results, different bond dimensions, and that's this additional parameter chi which controls the accuracy of the contraction. And then you see, I mean, for a small bond dimension, it converges very rapidly. And as you go to higher bond dimensions, it takes longer to converge. And in the end, here, there can still be some small deviation. But what was important here for the TJ model was the observation that the values come actually from above, right? So because in the end, you want to make sure that your energy you get is still variational. That you can claim you have a variational energy. Because the answer is variational, but things could go wrong in the approximate contraction. So that's why these checks are important. But there are also other cases where if you use a too small bond dimension, that things are not variational anymore. So one has to be careful and do this analysis in a careful way if you want to make claims about variational energies.
Okay, we're back at 10:45 sharp. Let's thank you again.
Thank you.